Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in for this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host. Welcome, 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 wherever you may be in the world. If you are a regular listener, if you can take a couple seconds and leave a review or rating of Causes or Cures on iTunes or Spotify, that would be amazing. And if you are a new listener, awesome. I know you have to check out a few episodes before leaving a review. That's okay. But in all seriousness, whoever does leave a review, thank you. I know it can be a pain in the butt to do so, but they really do help independent podcasts grow and gain momentum. All right, and now on to today's topic. What do you guys think of taxes on sugar-sweetened drinks? Sugar-sweetened drinks. Now, it's been proposed and used as a public health measure. But it's also controversial for a few reasons, which I will discuss with our guest on today's episode. My guest is Dr. slash Professor Scott Kaplan, who studies this stuff. He did an interesting recent study that I just read, and he will tell you more about himself in the podcast. But today's episode will look into the background on the sugar-sweetened beverage tax, the potential benefits to health, the potential economic benefits, and some of the controversy around these taxes, including that they are too big brotherish, and including pushback from the sugary beverage industry itself. As you can imagine, they're not too big on these things. And when you are done listening to the episode, get in touch and tell me what your thoughts are on it. Okay? All right. Give me a couple seconds here while we connect to Dr. Kaplan. Okay, everybody, we are connecting with Dr. Scott Kaplan, who is an economist, and he wrote a really interesting paper about sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. It was published in JAMA Health Forum, I believe, so a really good journal. And I'm really interested in this topic because, well, it comes up in a lot of public health debates, you know, like should we tax these sugar-sweetened beverages or not? But before we dive into that, Scott, do you mind taking a few minutes to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work you do?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great to be on. So I have a PhD in agricultural and resource economics from UC Berkeley. And most of my work is in the food and nutrition policy spaces. And so I've worked on a variety of nutrition related policy or food related policy, including product labeling, and of course on sugar sweetened beverage taxes. And this topic was important. I got my PhD at Berkeley, which was the first city to introduce one of these taxes. And I think the Bay Area in general has been a place where we've seen a lot of these taxes crop up. But of course, other big cities like Philadelphia and Seattle and Boulder have introduced these taxes. And so, I come at trying to understand the impact of these taxes from an economics standpoint. There's a lot of public health literature. Of course, there's a lot of literature looking at the health impacts associated with intake of added sugar in people's diets. One, as an economist, I'm always interested in kind of like what kind of magnitude are we, is at stake here with these types of policies. And a stat from the CDC that really kind of convinced me that this is an important question is that actually the majority of all added sugar in the average adult American diet comes from sugar sweetened beverages. It's like a quarter of all sugar intake. And so, the understanding the impact of soda taxes on consumption behavior and health was a topic that really interested me with this food and nutrition background. And that's what the study aims to look at is how these taxes are affecting people across different cities in the US.
Great. And you're a professor
Yes, at the Naval Academy. I'm
at the
a
Naval
professor of
Academy.
and the economics department at the Naval Academy. Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to have to ask you this. Otherwise, my class, my alma mater, I wouldn't live up to it. But how did it feel when we beat you guys?
Oh yeah. Well,
How was it?
this year, okay. So I'll be honest. I am always interested in a good game, and this year
Oh.
the game was excellent. It came right
I
down to the end
know. I know.
on the 1 yard line. So It didn't feel good, but I'm always happy, besides a Navy loss to have a close game. So we'll get you
Yeah.
guys next year.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a party at West Point and with all the old grads. So, can you talk a little bit, just to kind of lay the land here for people, the theory behind the sugar sweetened beverage tax, perhaps, and tie it in to how it is or could be used as a public health measure?
Yeah, definitely. So there's been a lot of work linking added sugar intake to adverse health outcomes related to diet, like diabetes and obesity. And it's sort of been an open and also controversial question of how to target that type of intake so that we can think about the cost of that. Might be being imposed on the healthcare system as a result of this intake. So the kind of key issue here, whenever we want to think about a tax and economics, is there some sort of like market failure? What do I mean by market failure? Is the sort of free market, the untouched market, sort of not doing its job in generating social well-being to both producers and consumers? And when you think about sugar, the key issue is that when someone's going to the doctor or receiving healthcare treatments for sugar-related disease like diabetes and obesity, they're really imposing an additional burden on the rest of society. Let's maybe focus on the U.S. For the sake of argument. So, the issue, kind of to give a simple analogy, would be, Aaron, if you are super healthy and you're, monitoring what sugar you intake, and you're not using the doctor for these reasons all that much, but I'm relatively unhealthy and drinking a lot of sugar sweetened beverages and then going to the doctor as a result because I'm at higher risk for diabetes and other things. We're both paying into this kind of pool that's being used to cover those healthcare costs just based on how the insurance system works in the US. And this, by the way, would be the case even in a universal healthcare pay system, because the burden would just fall on all taxpayers. And so the key kind of issue is like, how do we address this sort of social externality that's being produced by excess added sugar intake in terms of creating this healthcare cost burden on the rest of society? And one popular policy mechanism, not just in sugar sweetened beverage taxes, but in all kinds of goods that produce these social externalities, particularly negative externalities, are taxes. And so we hear about taxes all the time, as it relates to carbon taxes, for instance, or cigarette taxes or alcohol taxes. And the theory suggests you should really only tax a good when it's producing this externality on society. And so it becomes sort of more difficult and nuanced in the case of sugar sweetened beverages. It's, what we're really trying to do is curb excess consumption of added sugar. But how do you do that effectively? That's an important question, because you don't just want to start by saying, let's just tax sugar, because sugar is, an important nutrient in all kinds of food that we eat that keeps us healthy. And, we certainly wouldn't want to tax food that's nutritious in any way. I mean, that's, we sh if anything, we should be subsidizing that, which there are some policies in the US that exist to do that. But, as it corresponds to sugar sweetened beverages, we really call this a source of non-nutritional calories. And why we call it that is because sugar-sweetened beverages don't really offer any sort of nutritional value, unlike other foods that might contain added sugar. And so it's kind of a logical starting point when you want to think about curbing excess sugar intake without creating this sort of other perverse incentive associated with consuming nutritious food. So that's kind of why I think sugar sweetened beverage taxes themselves have taken off, not just in the US, but across the world. There's also other taxes that kind of target processed foods, but the sugar content associated with those foods. And so I think the US has gotten to a point, certainly with some of these more progressive cities, where they feel that the first step in this first economic step, really, in this battle to curb excess costs associated with sugar intake can be fought by using these local level taxes on sugar sweetened beverages.
Okay, great. And a few questions down the line, I want to get into some of the arguments against them and to hear your
Sure.
thoughts on those. And I was Out of curiosity, and just to kind of let our listeners know, how prevalent do you know? Like approximately, are these very popular in cities throughout the US and now the
Yeah.
world? Yeah, okay.
Well, there's over 50 countries that have implemented some form of a sugar content related tax. They vary in terms of what types of products they target, but generally speaking, sugar sweetened beverages are kind of the common theme with these policies across the world. There are, I think, currently 9 US jurisdictions that have some form of a sugar sweetened beverage tax. A couple of those, including Washington, D.C., where I am, are a slight increase in the sales tax on these products. So you can imagine in DC, I think the sales tax is 6%. So instead of paying 6% on purchases of these products, you pay 8%, which is not a huge tax, sort of from an economic standpoint. But most of the kind of effective taxes, and the ones that we study in our paper, are excise taxes. So these are taxes on a per ounce basis, and they range anywhere from 1 cent to 2 cents per ounce. And if you think about kind of the typical cost of a soda or sort of a general sugar sweetened beverage, that's going to be a relatively meaningful tax. I mean, the kind of baseline that I use is if you buy a can of Coke that's a dollar and it's 12 ounces, you're going to be paying an additional 12% on that if you're paying 1 cent per ounce. And obviously that tax is going to scale quite a bit if you start buying, 2 liter bottles of Coke or big multi-packs. And so that's sort of the kind of landscape of what these taxes generally look like. Maybe I'm I forget what your original question was, or was it to explain just the can
No, that's
hopefully
okay.
edit that out.
I just wanted to give our listeners an idea of how prevalent these
Oh
taxes
yes,
were and where they
good.
are. Yeah.
So I think nine jurisdictions in the U.S. and then there have been a couple of places that have had them and repealed them. And so, yeah, they're in fact the most recent one was implemented in 2018, and so there haven't been any new local level SSB taxes introduced in the U.S. since then. And part of the reason for that actually is because many of the states that have cities with these taxes have introduced bills to kind of preempt the future introduction of bills at the local level that could be voted on to potentially pass these taxes, and that's been a source of big controversy. Because the reason why many of these states are passing these bills is related to kind of regulatory capture influences of the beverage industry. And so, anyways, it's an important kind of political economic question, beyond just the health sort of story, I think, of these taxes is, why are they where they are, and kind of how do we think about them going forward?
I did two previous podcasts. One was on regulatory capture, just kind of explaining what it was, and then another one was a researcher came on and talked about how the food industry, the not so good food industry, I guess you would call maybe the unhealthy food industry, how much power they had over dietary guidelines and nutritional conferences, which I'm sure you're
Right.
aware of. Yeah.
Yeah,
It's, you know,
it's a huge,
yeah.
like, speaking towards how the beverage industry has found itself in some of these debates and landscapes. In Berkeley, there was a big campaign leading up to the election of deciding whether or not they were going to implement an SSB tax. And there was a ton of money put into that campaign from the beverage industry. In fact, I think the main campaign slogan in Berkeley was Berkeley versus Big Soda. And you really had these two, you had a very like community-oriented population of people who care a lot about health and being healthy and people's well-being. And then another side that felt very strongly about, I'm sure that they could see that this could be the first of many dominoes to fall if Berkeley passed this. And so anyways, there's a really kind of interesting dimension of this, which relates to how the different interest groups are feeding off of the taxation policies.
Yeah, it's not an easy fight. So your study, you looked at several cities, Boulder, Colorado, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Oakland, Seattle, and San Francisco. So can you just summarize what you did and what the primary outcomes you were looking for?
Yeah, we look at these five cities, and What we try to do is compare these five cities, which receive attacks at some point during our study period. We look at data from the beginning of 2012 until the end of or until February of 2020, right before COVID kind of took off. And our data is at the three-digit zip code level, and we basically we get to this data by it's a retail scanner data set. So what you can imagine the data set looks like is each observation is a type of product sold in a certain store during a certain week of the year. And what we essentially do with that data is we aggregate it up to the three-digit zip code level, which is the geographic identifier we have in the data. And so each of these five cities fall under one of these three-digit zip codes. And what we try to do is we try to create what we call in the paper synthetic zip codes or synthetic control groups. And what that essentially kind of to break that down, what it means is we have a bunch of zip codes that are not taxed. And some of those zip codes look pretty similar to the ones that are taxed. And you can imagine Philadelphia in terms of population density and how much soda is sold might be similar to other large urban cities like New York and Los Angeles. And not very similar to other zip codes, very rural, very sparse population zip codes. And what our algorithm basically does, and to be clear, like we didn't create this algorithm. This is some smarter folks than us that understand statistics. Basically, what it does is it weights each of these zip codes sort of proportionally to how similar it looks to the tax zip codes that we look at. And so that's one dimension of the study. And then the other, or of the method, and then the other is basically evaluating the pre-tax period in these zip codes. So, what's happening to sales and consumption and prices in these tax cities before the taxes even went into place, and then what's happening after they went into place. And you can imagine, we basically build these synthetic zip codes based on patterns or trends that we see in these tax cities before they actually get the tax. And so you try to basically create like a carbon copy of these tax zip codes. And then once the taxes go into effect, you sort of let the zip codes kind of just do their own thing. And we see how consumption changes in tax zip codes versus these synthetic untaxed zip codes. And what we find, we look at three primary outcomes. We look at purchases of sugar sweetened beverages. We look at prices of sugar sweetened beverages, and we look at purchases of sugar sweetened beverages in immediately adjacent bordering zip codes. And what we find is that as a result of these taxes, prices of these products went up by about 33% in the areas that were taxed compared to areas that were not taxed, these sort of synthetic areas. And as a result, consumption, or we measure purchases fell by sort of an equivalent amount by 33%. And I think importantly, and this has been a contradictory finding in other studies, we don't find any evidence of purchases increasing in immediately adjacent bordering areas. And so basically what that tells us is that these taxes are effective in reducing consumption. They increase prices, which is, we think, the mechanism by which consumption is going down, and there's not this offsetting impact of purchases in cross-border areas, which might sort of limit or dilute the effectiveness of these taxes.
And you mentioned in some other studies, they did see that.
That's right. Yeah, some other studies, and it depends quite a bit on the type of data that's used. So, in particular, you can imagine the granularity of data would play a large role in your ability to pick up these cross-border effects. So our data is relatively coarse in the sense that it's at the three-digit zip code level. However, what's nice about our data is that it's nationally comprehensive. Some existing studies have data that is at like the store level that you can really like track exactly where a store is in terms of how many miles, it is in terms of from the border. And they're able to pick up kind of very micro level changes in consumption. And so, that being said, like our bordering areas do include lots of stores right on the border, but it's going to be diluted in some way by the stores that are not right on the border. And so, if there was meaningful cross-border shopping, we still would have picked it
You would have
up. But
saw it, yeah.
yeah, we still would have saw it. But because we don't see it, it suggests that it's not a very meaningful result of these taxes.
That's
Now,
interesting.
other studies have found, particularly in Philadelphia, where I think most of the work is focused on this question, and that's partly, I think, because Philadelphia's tax is really large, relative. It's a 1.75 cent per ounce tax, and so you might expect people to respond in a greater or more meaningful way to a bigger tax. And in that setting, there have been studies that have shown some effects on cross-border shopping, but not enough to offset the reductions that have been seen, like in the city jurisdiction that's taxed itself. So it sort of
Interesting.
depends on, the taxes. The studies have found taxes are quite effective. It's just the magnitude of effectiveness to kind of depends a little bit on where you're looking and how big the tax is, and geography of where borders are, and then of course like how granular the data is that you're looking at with respect to stores near the border.
That's so interesting, even just from a human behavior perspective. You're like, how far are people willing to travel to get this
Right.
soda that they want?
Right. And I'm sure for a lot of people, this is speculation, but just anecdotally, I'm sure for a lot of people, it depends on, are you making a big grocery trip or a small grocery trip? Is soda a big part of your consumption basket? How close are you to the border? A lot of these factors, I heard from a colleague who has looked a lot at the Seattle tax. Apparently, like Seattle, and I've never visited Seattle, but the geography makes it such that it would be very hard to cross-border shop because there's a lot of water, and getting to a bordering area would involve, quite a bit of effort. Whereas in other places, I can certainly say in Berkeley, you're right on the border of Oakland, and Oakland now has a sugar sweetened beverage tax, but when Berkeley first implemented its tax, Oakland didn't. And it would be very easy, relatively speaking, to just jump across the border and not just buy your soda, but buy, your other groceries too. And so, yeah, I think it depends a lot on the types of people and the types of geography that kind of the cities exhibit.
Now, I know your study didn't tie the drop in consumption to health outcomes, but I was just curious if there is any indication. I mean, intuitively, we might know, oh, if you decrease consumption, you'll probably have some sort of health benefit. Excuse me. But is there like a magic percentage where you're like, oh, I want to see consumption drop by that much, and then, hey, we'll see the health benefits.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I don't think I can give you a magic percentage, but I can tell you what some other studies have done. Basically, there's a set of studies that have tried to link consumption reductions or price increases as a result of these taxes, run it through, a fancy, well-calibrated simulation to generate some impacts on important health outcomes that we might think are associated with added sugar. There's, of course, a large literature documenting the negative health effects of sugar in general, but there's sort of this intermediate literature, I think, that you're referring to, Aaron, which is like, how do these SSB taxes actually lead to health benefits? And there, since these taxes are relatively new and these health benefits are more difficult to study and more nuanced and take a long time to manifest, there haven't been, like magic bullet studies that have said, okay, like, this type of tax is going to lead to this type of health benefit. But the simulations basically suggest that even a 15 to 20% reduction in consumption can have substantial health benefits. I mean, that word substantial is vague, and I think it's probably vague on purpose, but some of these studies give you actual like numerical reductions in diabetes incidence and obesity incidence and strokes and all kinds of things that medical professionals would be looking at as a result of excess sugar. The other side of this is not just the health side, it's how much cost savings are these taxes generating for society, kind of related to the first point I was bringing up, which is, my choice to consume sugar, to the extent that it leads to me going to the doctor more and relying on the healthcare system more, does place this cost burden on other, other insurance payers or taxpayers in a universal healthcare system. And what they found basically is that 15 to 20% reduction can lead to cost savings that are on the order of $270 per person over the average lifetime of a person in the US. So That doesn't seem very large because a lifetime for most people in the US is pretty long. But if you kind of scale this up to a national level, like if we had national level taxation, this would correspond to like $45 billion in cost savings to society as a result of reductions in these health events that we think are associated with added sugar. So I think the key takeaway right now and with literature is that there's a lot at stake basically in trying to reduce excess sugar intake because it's a really costly and prevalent source of health out negative health outcomes and healthcare costs, and especially in the US.
Yeah, no, I mean, we have such a chronic disease epidemic and it's hitting younger and younger people. And then you tie that trend in with the cost of our healthcare system, which is
Right.
astronomical. It's like these two things are not sustainable.
Yeah,
Right?
we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of that dovetails into why these taxes are somewhat controversial. It's not just because the targeting of these taxes, is controversial, which we can talk about, but I think we're still undergoing this cultural adjustment and understanding. And I heard a good anecdote. I forgot from who, but they were mentioning, COVID has created a little bit more attention on our individual well-being because there was so much information and so much emphasis placed on staying healthy and avoiding hospitals. And I think, there's been some related, I think, yeah, that discussion has created some related discussions in the food policy and nutrition spaces. To try to get people to understand kind of how their decisions are impacting health, not just for themselves, but kind of like societal health in general. And I think that actually is why you see this specific set of cities being the ones to have these taxes, be the early adopters of these taxes. And I can especially speak to the Bay Area. The Bay Area has this level of health awareness and health consciousness and care for health that many other places, I think, in our country haven't gotten to yet. And so, I think that's part of the reason why you see some of these taxes where they are.
All right, so that's a good segue into some of, I guess, the criticism of these taxes. I guess the one I've heard the most working in public health is that it's regressive. It's a regressive tax. It's going to target poor people more than rich people. And is that something you really want to do? So what are your thoughts on that, or how would you respond to a critique like that?
I think that's a totally legitimate critique. I think these taxes are regressive in the sense that lower income folks tend to spend a higher share of their income on sugar sweetened beverage products than higher income folks. And as a result, the tax is going to hit them harder than it would a higher income folks. I think this is a lot of taxes are. A lot of these types of sin taxes are regressive, but not, I mean, not just sin taxes. A carbon tax would also be regressive because, folks that
Sure.
energy is an essential,
Yeah.
kind of thing we all need to spend money on. And so I think it's less of a question of like, oh, it's regressive, we should just immediately nix it, and more about, well, how can you develop creative policy solutions that factor in that regressivity into how you design these policies? I think, with carbon taxes, for example, there's been lots of work about, crediting back lower income households that and that credit comes from the pool of money that's generated by the tax. I think you could see something similar in soda taxes. I mean, the way these taxes are used differs across cities that have them. But for example, in Berkeley, the tax dollars were used to promote nutritional education and well-being for children in particular. And so, to the extent that that might help poor households who maybe don't have as easy access to information, maybe it's important to have that. But of course, there are ways to design policies, taxation policies that limit the regressivity of their impact. And so, I think with soda taxes, that's absolutely something that needs to be studied further. And it hasn't been a major source of economic research. Of course, there's been public health research looking at how these taxes have affected certain types of communities. And so, yeah, I think taxation design is something that's definitely on the table with respect to making these taxes fit more fair and more effective.
Yeah, I read somewhere where someone said it takes the choice out of the equation, or you're taxing something and you're taking away the choice. And when you hear that in America, like because we love our freedom here, that's like a big deal for a lot of people. But then I started to think about it a little more, and going back to where we when we spoke about regulatory capture and stuff, I'm like, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Like if you can say, get some of these really addictive, what I'm going to say addictive, substances, sugar, I mean, some people will argue that, but sugary foods, processed foods, because the way that they're designed and people just want more and more and they're bad for us, maybe having less choice in that area is a good thing, in a way. But and I don't really know where I stand on the issue entirely, but
And choice is such a loaded word, I think, when you think about
yes.
like the economics and policy making. Because like I would argue as an economist that a tax is the type of policy that preserves choice more than many other policies would. I mean, I can imagine certainly like a ban of something totally limits choice. I mean, we see this debate all the time in the context of genetically modified foods, the right to choose, the right to know. And there's all kinds of policies in the nutrition and food spaces that have a there's a spectrum basically of the amount of choice that you essentially allow. And a tax, like, no products are going away necessarily from the tax. I mean, if people will start not to buy them because they're expensive, then maybe the firms will make certain decisions about which products to offer. And certainly you could argue that these types of taxes are going to lead to reformulation of some products, like companies introducing more low or no sugar alternatives, and trying to retain some of that market share that they might lose from these taxes. But that being said, like the tax is just creating a price incentive for folks to reduce their consumption. I don't think anyone would say that like we should all go from wherever we are in soda or sugar sweetened beverage consumption to zero. I mean, people still enjoy soda, and there's a reason to think that these taxes will reduce consumption of those things, but not totally just be away with them. And so it's a fine line, and how the narrative is portrayed about it. But I don't see a sugar sweetened beverage tax as something that's really limiting choice. Of course, it's making it harder to afford or more expensive to buy these products. But if you want them bad enough, no one's saying, don't do that. I mean, it's your money to spend. And so, I think from an economic standpoint, what we really think about the tax doing is reducing consumption and hopefully compensating for some of these sugar-based externalities that are imposing additional costs in society. But saying we should ban sugar-sweetened beverages and make sure no one consumes it ever again, I don't think
Yeah,
that's the narrative.
a ban's never a good word to use here.
Because and not just that, because a ban creates all kinds of other negative issues, not just in sugar-sweetened beverages, but in other spaces as well. I mean, we should ban things that are like toxic and will kill people, and that are really serious. And like, we shouldn't be banning things that that have these kind of links to important health outcomes, but are
You could
essentially,
still enjoy it at a birthday party or something like,
there's reasons to see the benefits associated with some of these things too. So it's not all bad.
I know, I'm not sure if actually this might have been in the discussion of your paper and I overlooked it, but as an economist, in terms of the effect it would have on the beverage companies themselves, the financial cost, is it pretty significant?
That's a good question. So I think, and this is actually something we study to some extent as well, and other people have studied too. So there's a question of basically the way these taxes work is they're placed on the distributors of these beverages, so on the firms, or I guess on the there's there's some, in some instances, like a middleman, basically. Like there's a firm that's producing the product, and there's some like distributor of the products to the stores, and then there's like the consumers of these products. And so the tax is not placed on the consumers. And so it's a question of essentially of how much of this tax is going to get passed through to the final price that consumers face. And so, there's been a wide range of estimates of this, depending on the city and data. We find in our paper that there is a 92% pass-through of this tax to the price the consumer sees. And that doesn't mean that the firm isn't gonna feel more than that, whatever remaining amount is that they're eating, because consumers are gonna consume less of this, and then that's gonna generate less revenues for these firms. And so I think it's still, it's not a question that it's easy to study, because it requires a lot of proprietary data from these firms to figure out exactly, how their bottom lines are being hit. And I'm sure that they're keeping that close to their chest, because they don't want to have the full economic story out there. But I can speak to just how the prices have changed, and the prices have changed. At least in our study, we find the prices change almost sort of fully in response to, like, there's a full path, almost full pass through the tax to consumers. And so clearly there's some responsiveness of these firms to the taxes in trying to pass the burden on to the consumers of these products.
The consumers. So overall, do you see this as a positive? I mean, it's funny because it's really interesting because you speak, you're an economist and I'm coming at it from a public health, so it's really interesting to hear your point of view, versus I'm always bombarded by the public health point of view, but do you think that this we're going to see more of this? And yeah.
That's a great question. I think that's a highly political question these days, just based on the climate we live in, and both local and higher levels of government are struggling to see this pass very basic and highly popular things. I don't know the future, but my guess is that these taxes still have quite a bit of resistance at the state level, based on these bills that have been introduced to preempt their future introduction. These taxes, I think, will remain controversial just by their nature. I think it's not as clean cut as like a cigarette tax or a carbon tax, because what we're really trying to do is, as policymakers and as economists, is we're trying to correct this external cost placed on others, essentially, through the way the healthcare system works. And ideally, what's the ideal thing we would target? The ideal thing we would target is, direct links from sugar intake to the diseases that are creating this additional burden. And but that's very difficult to do, because who knows why someone, gets diabetes or becomes obese. It's a plethora of factors. And so I think, what's good about these taxes is it's a source of non-nutritional calories that have a lot of added sugar. So I think in that sense, it's the best type of product to tax if we're trying to get at this problem. But I don't, there is no silver bullet with the way our healthcare landscape is set up. And so I'm kind of interested to see how, what other policies get proposed for these types of externalities, because I've sort of yet to see something that's kind of not controversial in this space. And so yeah, so
Everything's
I think
controversial.
yeah, I think it just it's a really hard externality to target. And especially when you consider other, other externalities that are much easier to target, like even the cigarette extra like tax makes a lot sort of more transparent sense, because cigarettes are clearly linked to this lung cancer outcome, which is clearly linked to bad sort of seeing the doctor more, and surgeries and all kinds of things that are costly for society. Not to mention the fact that smoking a cigarette near someone clearly causes secondhand smoke externalities. And so I think it's just a lot easier of a narrative and story to tell. I mean, carbon tax, it's the same thing. Like, we know CO2 creates a warming of our atmosphere, and we know the warming of our atmosphere creates all kinds of bad sort of outcomes in terms of rising temperatures and more extreme weather events. And so I just think that we're not only fighting an uphill battle within this space, like this food and nutrition space, but when you compare to like other more clean cut taxes designed to correct these externalities, it's just a tough comparison. So, I think it's better than what else, whatever else we have. Like, so it's the what the least worst option at the moment, but I'm certainly paying close attention to other policy recommendations to try to not only improve the like health impact side and the cost impact side to society, but that make economic sense too.
Sure. And that makes a lot of sense. And I agree with you. There's so much controversy. I would, though, like to see the regulatory capture just a little less of that. I mean, it's
Sure, yeah.
so bad at this point. It's everywhere,
Yeah.
every level of our government.
I
And
agree. Yeah, there's a lot of money at stake, clearly. That's the reason why it's happening.
money,
And
yep.
yeah, I mean, there's a huge industry that's producing these products. And it's funny, like in response to this study, you have the American Beverage Association spokesperson kind of come out and give their take. And I think it's always interesting to me as an economist that this kind of take like resonates with people. But essentially they were saying, oh, well, sugar intake from these beverages it's the lowest it's ever been, and more than 60% of the products we produce have something like no sugar. I don't know what something about basically we're already doing well with sugar intake, and that's striking to me because these ta yes, there is the secular downward trend in consumption of sugar sweet beverages. Like I think the population is getting is understanding these like the negative impacts of sugar, is finding good alternatives. We see all kinds of good alternatives from a beverage standpoint that have no sugar now. But these taxes are in addition to those things. So it's not like it's already just being, that 32% reduction in consumption that we find in our study is not kind of like taking into account these trends that already exist. It's 30% in addition to these trends, right? Because these trends are existing in the places that aren't taxed, and that's our comparison group. And so I think what that statement I think is trying to do is say these taxes don't work. The work is already being done. And the reality is the taxes are working a lot, I think, even in addition to these trends that we're seeing. And so yeah, I don't know. The regulatory capture side, it's such a word, what words you use and kind of yeah, how what messaging you're using and framing. And I think it's important that people, like through your podcast, like people get the facts of what are these taxes actually doing and why are they being implemented. And it's good to have both a secular downward trend and reduction in consumption from these taxes. I think that's getting us even closer towards the right amount of sugar intake.
Yeah. And I think people are interested in a lot, like you said, a lot of different approaches. It's not going to be just one. It's got to be a bunch of different approaches at all
Yeah.
different levels to tackle anyways the chronic health issues that we're seeing that are going to cost a lot.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you so much. My last question for you, are you working on any new research in this area? Any more studies coming out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, right now we're trying to extend some of this work. So this work looks at the volume reduced of sugar sweetened beverage purchases. And kind of related to our conversation, it's not necessarily the volume of sugar-sweetened beverages that we care about. It's the amount of sugar being reduced that we care about. Because, you could have a sugar-sweetened beverage with 5 grams of added sugar. You could have another sugar-sweetened beverage with 50 grams of added sugar. And those are going to have vastly different impacts if we sort of believe, which we should, this link between sugar and the health outcomes we're trying to prevent. And so what some of our new work is trying to do is really understand whether the reduction in sugar, from purchases of these beverages is proportional to the reduction in ounces. And that'll give us a better understanding of if these taxes are really targeting the thing that we think they should be targeting, which is sugar and less so volume. And so, I think I'm pretty excited about seeing, and by the way, not just sugar, but calories, other basically nutritional characteristics in these products that we might care about more from a health outcome standpoint than like the actual volume itself. And so I'm excited to see how these yeah how the changes in sugar intake are going to compare to the changes in volume intake. And my guess is that I think it may even be larger, like the impacts might even be larger because you see a lot the question is where is this tax going to hit the hardest? What types of products is this tax going to hit the hardest? It's going to hit the hardest on very high volume sugar sweetened beverages, like big products, like 2 liter bottles that are relatively cheap otherwise, because the tax is on a per ounce basis. And so if I've got a 64 ounce 2 liter bottle, that's going to be 64 cents if it's a 1 cent per ounce tax. You can buy some of those 2 liter bottles in grocery stores for like a dollar. I mean, it's depending on like kind of what types of bargains you're looking at. So
Sure.
I think people are basically what I think might be happening is people are reducing smaller versions of these products less, like the can of Coke here, the bottle of or the can of Red Bull there. But I think they might be reducing these larger, very sugar intensive, kind of bigger volume products because that's where the tax is hurting you the most. If you're buying these 2 liter bottles at the corner store for a dollar, and the tax is 1 cent per ounce, that's gonna increase the price by 64 cents. That's gonna be quite meaningful for you. So, anyways, I'm excited to dig a little bit deeper into the actual nutritional
Yeah, that's
changes
very
and
interesting.
response
It's
to these
very
taxes.
timely.
Yeah. So, anyways, we're basically circling around, how do we most effectively, economically, from a health standpoint, from a regulatory capture standpoint, and considering the pushback from different industries, how do we most effectively target this problem, which is excess sugar intake that creates this health burden on a health and cost burden on society? So, more work to be done.
More work to be done. There we are. Well, thanks so much. This is great stuff, Scott, and I wish you a lot of luck. Stay in touch and let me know if you find anything interesting in your I actually found your hypothesis interesting because it's not what I would have thought, but I'm not doing the work. But yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. It's really great because there's so many people in the health profession that care a lot about mapping linkages between some of these nutritional
Yeah.
characteristics like sugar to health outcomes. And I think as an economist, it's fun to like leverage so much knowledge about that link and try to provide some more insight into, well, how do we get to that end result that we all care about, and how do we do
Yeah.
it in the most cost effective and sensible way. And so I'm excited to see how that pans out, but excited to explore more food related policy and nutrition related policy in the future
Yeah.
too.
Yeah. And it does, but public health is always, there's always an economic side that maybe sometimes gets lost, when you're in the field or you're just thinking in this public health bubble. But I mean, we even saw that during COVID though, right? Like,
Right.
for example, lockdowns, and you're like, oh, well, stay away. But then you're like, what is the economic impact of that? And how is that going to
Right.
hurt? There's just so many elements. It's
Yeah.
of course,
There's
it's,
all kinds of trade-offs that you have to
yes,
like weigh. And
trade-offs. Yeah.
if we all, cared about being, 100% healthy all the time, that'd be an extremely costly endeavor. And
Yeah.
so we, right. So you have to basically weigh, I mean, it sounds cliche, but you have to weigh benefits and costs basically when you're thinking about these policies and the types of outcomes you're trying to generate. And
Yeah.
there's no silver bullet, and policies are, never perfect, but
Yeah.
we try to iterate towards something that makes both economic and health related sense,
Makes sense.
and build on that. So that's what I think that's I think what the space is trying to do with soda tax versus sugar sweetened beverage taxes, because it's a difficult mechanism, and it's hard to target the thing we really care about, but I think it's important enough that we should really care a lot about it and try to figure out the best solution. And so I think that's what we're trying to do.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. Do you guys have snow down there?
We do.
You
Oh,
do?
lots of snow. Yeah, it's like
Really?
the first time it snowed. I've been in DC for, let's say, almost 2.5 years now,
Yeah.
and this is the second time really it's meaningfully snowed. And so yeah, we have a dog now who wasn't here for the first snow we had, so it's been really fun to run around with him.
Yeah. Well, I gotta go get my dog from the groomers. And because it's like snowing and sleeting out there, this really expensive haircut will get ruined in like the minute I walk out of the salon, but there we are.
Such as life as a dog owner, it's
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Dear God.
yeah, I hope it was okay. Like I tried, yeah,
No, it was
anyways,
great. It was
yeah,
great. Yeah.
okay.
I don't think it was above anybody's head. So
Okay.
And yeah, it was good. And I think it
I
gives
think,
people a lot to think about.
yeah, I mean, I hope that, I think a lot of, like you were saying, like public health people can come on and say, like, in fact, even some of the people on the team that I work with who are doctors, it's very much like, it's a no-brainer. Like, sodium oxybutynin is like, it's going to improve health. And I think it's important to have not a negative, I'm not providing a negative perspective, but I think it's a realistic perspective of kind of why are these controversial? It's important to like lend some credence to it because there are some legitimate reasons that it's controversial. I think that that's okay. And in fact, like it's not what I think makes it more, we should take that controversy more seriously. It's like not quite on party lines per se. Like it's like there's some people very left that think these are paternalistic and have no place in society, and people on the right who are like, we need it because health is a really serious problem. So I think it's just good to open the dialogue of why it's controversial, and then hopefully that gets people thinking about just better, better ways of getting at this core issue, which is the health impacts of sugar. So,
Well,
anyways,
that's part of public health, having these dialogues and not like telling other people that they're wrong just because they disagree with you, right?
Like we should have evidence and we should have a discussion and figure out like basically like I have tons of students who are super healthy, like, as you know, at the Naval Academy,
Naval Academy.
they're extremely fit, and I can't tell you, like, more than any other subgroup people I know, they're always drinking energy drinks, they're always drinking this like crap to like keep them awake and stuff, and they're like some of the healthiest people in the nation, so it's I can understand how someone like that would be like, why should I have to pay tax, like I'm exercising every day. And so it's a complicated question. And there's the winners and losers, like there are with most of these policies, but I think it's important to, it's just important to like get those things out into the open so there can be a discussion about it.
Absolutely. And I'll have to end this with Beat Navy, of course.
Oh, that's a low blow.
podcast host, so I can do it,
Yes,
right?
that's right. You can edit out my beat army if you want, I guess.
It's okay. It's a fun little rivalry.
Yeah, that's kind of a nice sub story to our discussion, is this coming together of rivals.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Scott, well, enjoy the rest of your day there. Enjoy the snow, and I'll follow up on email. And thanks so much again.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in today's episode. I hope you join in for more episodes. And I hope if you find the time, you scroll on back and check out some of the other episodes. Not because of me, only because my guests are all very highly qualified folks, interesting, who are, in their specific fields, the horse's mouth, so to speak. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and my newsletter so you can stay up to date on podcast guests, topics, and blog topics. Alrighty then. And now for today's quote. This is from Anne Wigmore. The food you eat can be either the safest and most powerful form of medicine or the slowest form of poison. And sometimes not so slow. Like if you ever get food poisoning. Oh, I had food poisoning once at Denny's on the Strip in Las Vegas. Like right before I was going to the Strokes concert, the Strokes great band, and I was deathly ill. I ate eggs at the Strip, Denny's on the Strip, sorry, Denny's on the Strip in Vegas, and profuse, like vomiting, diarrhea. I mean, I was deathly ill, but I still went to the concert because I am a true fan, the Strokes. All right, that's it. I hope to see you here next time. Bye for now.